So, a lot of you don't know me. So, my name's Clara. I'm a graduate student in the Department of Logic and Philosophy of Science at the University of California, Irvine. And I'm going to be talking today about a question that's slightly different from what we've heard so far, but it's going to be a more foundational question, which is the one here. Do first-class constraints generate gauge transformations? And in this talk, I'm going to use a standard geometric framework in what I think is a new way to resolve a debate in the literature in physics and philosophy between the affirmative and the negative answer to this question. And I will end up agreeing with the orthodoxy on this question, but I think that considering the objections to this will help to shed light on why the orthodoxy is right. Okay, so just to start, some background on why this question arises. So we find that in several Lagrangian theories, there are these symmetries that are related to dependencies amongst the equations of motion, the Euler-Lagrange equations. And in such cases, we seem to have a breakdown of determinism in the sense that there is arbitrariness in the solutions to the equations of motion. But we think that this indeterminism is only apparent. It's an artifact of our mathematical description and not of the world, since we think, at least in the cases we're considering here, that the theories are in fact deterministic. And so this leads to the following kind of notion of a gauge transformation being a transformation that connects physically equivalent descriptions of the same state or history of a physical system. And in this way, what a gauge transformation is intrinsically connected to the interpretation of a theory in that it requires a notion of physical equivalence. And I've used the term state or history in this definition, since, as we'll see later on, part of the contention in the literature is precisely which term we should use here in this definition.
Sorry, do you have a microphone?
Yeah, I do. Okay. So given that we're in this situation, how do we combat this threat of indeterminism? Well, it turns out there's a natural framework for doing this called the constrained Hamiltonian formalism, pioneered particularly by these two figures, Paul Dirac and Peter Bergman. And what this formalism does is it allows one to provide a framework for identifying those variables that are invariant under the gauge transformations, which are called the observables, by linking constraints on what counts as a physically allowed state to gauge freedom. And it turns out that in this formalism, of particular importance are these constraints that are first class, which broadly are those that commute with each other in a particular way, but I'll say more precisely what those are later on. And in this talk, I'm going to focus particularly on the constrained Hamiltonian formalism as it comes from Dirac, which arguably has become the kind of standard framework for thinking about gauge freedom in this context. And in this Dirac formalism, the gauge transformations are defined as being generated by arbitrary combinations of first-class constraints. And Dirac thought that this definition of a gauge transformation had some important implications. The one that we're going to focus on in this talk is the fact that he thought that on the basis of this definition, we should extend the Hamiltonian to really be an equivalence class of Hamiltonians in order to include all of the gauge freedom. So the motivation here is that if we have arbitrariness in the solutions to the equations of motion, then because the Hamiltonian is the object that generates the dynamics, it ought to contain this arbitrariness so that it's explicit in the dynamics that there are these multiple mathematically distinct evolutions from some initial state. Now, as I said, this has arguably become the kind of standard view. However, there have been some arguments in the literature that Dirac was wrong. So just to give a few of the problems that have been given for this Dirac view, first, there have been some counterexamples to the claim that first-class constraints of a particular kind called the secondary ones generate gauge transformations. There have also been counterexamples to the more general claim that it's each first-class constraint that generates gauge transformations.
Are you going to define first class?
Yes, they're going to come later on. And Finally, there have been some arguments that Dirac's proof is faulty and limited in scope in various ways. And in light of some of these arguments, some people have put forward a different view, which I'm going to call the alternative view of gauge transformations, that it's rather a specific combination and not an arbitrary combination of first-class constraints that generates a gauge transformation. And from this, this alternative view concludes that one need not, or more strongly, one should not extend the Hamiltonian, at least to the extent that Dirac did. So we seem to have this debate in the literature between this Dirac view and in this alternative view. And in this talk, I'm going to try and resolve this debate by arguing that really what's going on is that the reasoning in both the Dirac and the alternative view is flawed, but that correct reasoning will end up validating the definition of a gauge transformation given by Dirac, namely that arbitrary combinations of first-class constraints generates a gauge transformation. But in doing so, I will diagnose the reasons that one might be led to this alternative view. Okay, so before I get into the details of this, why should we care about this question for quantum gravity? Well, of course, the constrained Hamiltonian formalism provides the basis for canonical quantization methods. And so, inasmuch as one thinks that these are appropriate methods of quantization, understanding better the foundations of the constrained Hamiltonian formalism and the right notion of a gauge transformation is important for ensuring that these methods are tracking the right degrees of freedom. And second, the constrained Hamiltonian formalism is the basis of the well-known problem of time, which at least in one formulation says that when the Hamiltonian is itself one of the first-class constraints, then this Dirac view leads to the conclusion that time evolution is just the unfolding of a gauge transformation. But if the Dirac view is not right, then perhaps this is an avenue for avoiding the problem of time. And indeed, some people who have put forward this alternative view have argued precisely this. A wider reason why this is an interesting question foundationally is that thinking about the gauge symmetries in the Hamiltonian framework and how they relate to the ones in the Lagrangian framework is important for thinking about the sense in which these two pictures can be said to be equivalent, in as much as the gauge symmetries are kind of a guide to the kind of structure that these theories impart on the world. And some advocates of this alternative view argue that it's only their view that matches the Lagrangian gauge transformations, and that, in fact, this is a reason that we should adopt their view, precisely because we should assume to start with that these two pictures are equivalent. Okay, so the rest of the talk's gonna go as follows. I'm first gonna broadly describe Dirac's recipe for constructing a constrained Hamiltonian theory and consider the argument that he gives for this Dirac view of gauge transformations. And then, for sake of space, just gonna consider one particular argument that's been given against Dirac and in favor of this alternative view. I'm then going to present this standard geometric framework for thinking about the constrained Hamiltonian formalism and argue why I think that it helps to illuminate how we can resolve this debate. And then I'm going to conclude with just some upshots and what I take to be the probably the best kind of response that someone who's a proponent of this alternative view might give against my arguments. Okay. So starting with this way of constructing in Dirac's framework the constrained Hamiltonian theory, the idea is that one starts with a Lagrangian written in terms of some position and velocity variables. Now, I'm going to assume throughout this talk, I'm just going to consider the case where we have an independent time variable. Now, of course, when we're thinking about theories like general relativity, it turns out to be important to include that as an additional dependent variable. But I'm just going to consider this case for the fact that this kind of question arises even in this more simple case. We then define what's called the canonical momenta as just the derivative of the Lagrangian with respect to the velocities. Then in the situation where these momenta variables are not independent of each other, we have what we call these primary constraints that are relationships between these position and momenta variables that we set weakly equal to zero, where this weakly means that we can only set it equal to zero on the subspace where these constraints hold. We then define what's called the total Hamiltonian, which is equal to the usual Hamiltonian plus an arbitrary combination of the primary constraints. So here, the lower and upper indices just indicates I'm taking a sum here. And you might notice that when the primary constraints hold, this total Hamiltonian is just equivalent to the usual Hamiltonian. We then derive the equations of motion for some function f as being the derivative of that function with respect to time is equal to the Poisson bracket of that function with the total Hamiltonian. We then use the fact that in order for the constraints, the primary constraints, to be consistent with the equations of motion, it ought to be the case that they continue to hold over time. So we put them into the equations of motion and set them weakly equal to zero. And in some cases, we'll find that there are further relationships on these P's and these Q's that we call the secondary constraints. We can then repeat this process by putting the secondary constraints into the equations of motion, setting them weakly equal to zero. And we might indeed find further constraints that we'll just continue to call the secondary constraints. Secondary because they come from thinking about the primary constraints under the equations of motion. And then once we have all the constraints, we can classify them according to whether they're first class, which means that the Poisson bracket of that constraint with all the other constraints, or including itself, is weakly equal to zero. And if it's not, then we call the constraint second class. Okay, so this is the basic picture. One thing that I don't have here is that the second class constraints, in fact, allow one to fix some of the arbitrariness in the total Hamiltonian. But the important thing here is that as long as we have first class constraints, our total Hamiltonian will have to be written as a first class Hamiltonian function and an arbitrary sum of primary first class constraints. So we're still going to be left with arbitrariness in our Hamiltonian.
Sorry,
yeah.
So that third step from define canonical momentum to derive primary constant. So what do you mean exactly? So that gives me some relation between P and Q dot, for example. That's first step basically. And then how do I derive primary constraints here?
Yeah, so they'll come from the definition of the canonical momentum, and particularly in the case where the canonical momenta are not independent of each other, there are dependencies between these canonical momenta, you find these relationships between the position and the momenta variables.
So you're basically saying that if there are some relationships that don't involve Q dots, then you call them primary. Is that understanding?
In the Hamiltonian framework, you're not making reference to the Q dots directly. You're defining everything through this canonical momentum variables.
Okay.
So in getting rid of reference to the velocities and just considering the momenta, in certain cases you find these relationships.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So now we're going to turn to how Dirac defines the gauge transformations. So for Dirac, a gauge transformation relates any two states that are possible evolutions from some initial state under the dynamics generated by the total Hamiltonian at some fixed infinitesimal time, delta t. So the idea here is that we think our theory is a complete one and that it ought to be deterministic, and yet we still have this arbitrariness in our dynamics. And so any two states that are reached under different choices of these arbitrary factors should be thought of as physically equivalent and so related by a gauge transformation. And so by considering two different choices of these arbitrary functions in this total Hamiltonian, Dirac shows that each primary first class constraint generates a gauge transformation. And moreover, on the basis of arguably more hand-wavy arguments, Dirac conjectures that it's also the case that each secondary first-class constraint that generates a gauge transformation. But now we're in this situation where our dynamics is given by the total Hamiltonian, which includes the arbitrariness associated with the primary first-class constraints, but we also think there's arbitrariness associated with the secondary first-class constraints. So what do we do? Well, this is where Dirac introduces this idea of the extended Hamiltonian. So quoting Dirac verbatim, he says, "We were led to the idea that there are certain changes in the P's and Q's that do not correspond to a change of state and which have as generators first class secondary constraints." So that suggests that we should consider a more general equation of motion with now an extended Hamiltonian consisting of the previous Hamiltonian, the total Hamiltonian, plus all those generators that do not change the state with arbitrary coefficients. So that includes also the secondary first class ones. So the final picture is this. The gauge transformations in this Dirac picture are generated by each first class constraint and arbitrary combinations of them. And the equations of motion are given by the equations of motion we had before, but where now we have this extended Hamiltonian consisting of a first class Hamiltonian function and an arbitrary combination of all of the first class constraints. Okay, so now I'm going to turn to one particular response that's been given to Dirac. And the one I'm going to consider here is from a 2005 paper by Pons, who argues that Dirac's proof of the gauge transformations is incomplete because it only gives a notion, an account of gauge transformations as transformations on states that is distinct from the standard and the right notion of a gauge transformation as one that maps between solutions to the equations of motion. And that when we consider this right notion, it turns out, he says, that the Dirac gauge transformations aren't the right ones. And in order to argue for this, what he does is he provides a definition of a gauge transformation that extends that of Dirac's, in that before we considered two different states at some infinitesimal time delta t, Pons is now going to consider the same states, but now for any time t. And in this way, he's now considering gauge transformations as mapping between entire solutions. And under this more general notion of a gauge transformation, what Pons does is shows that the form of the gauge transformations in this framework is rather given by this sum of first class constraints with some coefficient where psi here is an arbitrary function of time. But the important thing here is that the coefficient associated with each first class constraint in this sum are related to each other by being time derivatives of each other. That's the sort of parentheses I thing here. So this means that, for example, the transformation generated by only one of the first class constraints on its own may fail to be a gauge transformation. And indeed, examples of this kind have been given by other authors. So for example, there's a philosopher called Brian Pitts who's really pushed this idea that for the particular case of classical electromagnetism, in the Hamiltonian framework, the transformation generated by only one of the first class constraints generates what he calls a bad physical change. And it's really only a combination of this kind that really generates a gauge transformation. But interestingly, though, if we consider just a particular time t, then this equation for the gauge transformations reduces to the Dirac gauge transformations. The reason being that these time derivatives become independent at a particular time, and so we just have these independent arbitrary generators in this equation. And so in this way, Pons kind of says that Dirac gauge transformations are a special case of his notion of a gauge transformation. And so he concludes, it's really a specific combination of first class constraints that generates a gauge transformation, and therefore one need not introduce the extended Hamiltonian to account for all of the gauge freedom, because the total Hamiltonian contains all the information about the gauge transformations on solutions. There are only as many independent arbitrary functions of time as there are primary first-class constraints. Okay, so at this point, you might have the following kind of reaction, which is maybe a kind of, you think you can have your cake and eat it kind of response, which is to say, well, really, haven't I really just given you two notions of a gauge transformation? First, there's the notion of a gauge transformation as a map on states. And second, there's a notion of a gauge transformation as a map between solutions to the equations of motion. But why can't I just keep these two things apart and say that we just have two distinct concepts, the state gauge transformations and the solution gauge transformations, that just turn out to not coincide in the constrained Hamiltonian formalism? Well, I think that there's a conceptual issue with having this kind of distinction. The reason is that keeping these two distinct notions of a gauge transformation means that individual states along two curves can be gauge equivalent without it being the case that if one curve is a solution, then the other also is. But if we're understanding gauge equivalence to mean physical equivalence, then how can this be so? It would mean that all the individual states along two curves are physically equivalent, even though the sequence of states that makes up one curve is not physically equivalent to the sequence of states that makes up the other curve. Yeah.
Sorry, I know you said it, I just want to clarify. So I have a solution to the equations of motion. So at each instant, that's a state.
Mm-hmm.
Then at each instant, I do a gauge transformation. I get another sequence, but you're saying it's possible that that other sequence is not a solution.
That's at least what these proponents of this alternative view of gauge transformations are saying. And that's why I think there's a kind of conceptual issue with having those two things, precisely as you say. Because
so most people contend what I just said.
They contend that. Or they would say something like, it's the solution notion that's the primary one, that's the right notion, and we shouldn't consider gauge equivalence on states or something like that.
Sorry, is it that it's not a solution or it's just not an equivalent solution?
Not an equivalent.
Right.
No, I think they want to say more strongly that it's not, that if you take, yeah, that it's not a solution at all. It may like take you from a solution to something that doesn't satisfy the equations of motion. Yeah.
One more question. Are you assuming that the Hamiltonian has zero Poisson bracket with the constraints?
Yes. So, yes, in the case that you can, in general, at least Dirac showed that you can write the Hamiltonian, the total Hamiltonian and the extended one, as a sum of a Hamiltonian function that is first class, which means that its Poisson bracket with all the constraints is zero, weakly zero, plus this arbitrary combination, which means that the extended Hamiltonian is first class, and so its Poisson bracket with the constraints is zero. Yes, that's right. Okay. So we have this kind of conceptual tension. And I think that part of the reason that we end up in this tension is that the debate assumes that we have to reason in the following way. We first determine what the gauge transformations are using the total Hamiltonian, and then we use the gauge transformations to say whether we should do this extension to the Hamiltonian. But why couldn't we just go the other way around and first introduce the extended Hamiltonian and then use it to say what the gauge transformations are? And indeed, it can be shown that if one starts with an extended Hamiltonian, then the gauge transformations just are the Dirac ones for states and solutions. And so if one can show that the extended Hamiltonian has some independent motivation, then this would indicate that this kind of reasoning is faulty. And indeed, I think that we can show this, and that this is illuminated clearly once we move to the geometric kind of way of presenting the constrained Hamiltonian formalism. So that's what I'm going to turn to now. And as I'm going to present it, I don't take any of this to be new. This is the kind of standard way of formulating this formalism geometrically. So we start with defining our state space as being given by phase space, which is just the cotangent bundle of configuration space. Classically right now. Everything's classical because we're just considering the constrained Hamiltonian formalism as it first arises, and then we're questioning the notion of a gauge transformation because this is the formalism that will be used to quantize a theory in several cases. Okay, so yeah, everything's classical. We have this cotangent bundle of configuration space. This phase space comes equipped with a one form, which I call theta here, which is just PI dQI, and it has a corresponding two form given by the exterior derivative of theta, the one form, which has the property of being symplectic, which means that it's closed and non-degenerate. Now, on this phase space, given a function f, we can uniquely define a smooth tangent vector field through the fact that the two form acting on this smooth tangent vector field is equal to the differential of f. The symplectic manifold also gives rise to Poisson bracket structure in that the Poisson bracket between a function f and a function g is just given by the two form acting on the tangent vector fields associated with these functions. And naturally, we can define the equations of motion that we had before in this formalism, namely the Poisson bracket between a function f and a Hamiltonian is just equal to the derivative of that function with respect to the parameter that parameterizes the Hamiltonian vector field, which we just call time. And now thinking about the constraints in this formalism, so if we just confine ourselves to the case where we have first class ones, since those are the ones we're interested in, what that does is it gives rise to a submanifold of phase space called the constraint surface. And on this constraint surface, we can define an induced two-form on this surface, which is just the pullback of the embedding of the surface in the full phase space, which turns out to be degenerate, so it's not symplectic, it's rather presymplectic. And by being degenerate, it means that it possesses null vectors, and these turn out to be precisely the vector fields associated with the first class constraints. And we say that the integral curves of these null vector fields are the gauge orbits. So just to see this visually, if we consider a phase space that has three dimensions and we have one first class constraint, then this will define a two-dimensional surface in this space. And these orange lines here are just the integral curves of the vector field associated with this one first class constraint that importantly is tangent to this constraint surface and is such that the induced two-form acting on these vector fields is equal to zero. So now we can see here that this terminology of associating the null vectors with the gauge orbits already suggests that we're taking the first class constraints to generate gauge transformations. And indeed, that this is being supposed is already recognized in the literature. So just quoting a standard textbook on the constrained Hamiltonian formalism by Henno and Teitelbaum, they say the identification of the gauge orbits with the null surfaces of the induced two-form relies strongly on the postulate made throughout the book that all first-class constraints generate gauge transformations. So does this mean that the geometric view just is subject to the same criticism that we saw that Pons gave against Dirac's view? Well, as I suggested before, I'm going to argue that the answer is no. In fact, the geometric picture can be used to show that the reasoning in the debate is wrong. So remember, the reasoning in the debate was that we determine the gauge transformations using the total Hamiltonian, and then we use them to say whether we should extend the Hamiltonian to this extended Hamiltonian. But rather, I think we can actually do the reasoning in this geometric framework as follows. We can motivate the extended Hamiltonian and determine the gauge transformations on states independently from one another, and we can use these two things to show what the gauge transformations on solutions is supposed to be. So in this way, the extended Hamiltonian is not a consequence of reasoning about the gauge transformations, but rather has independent motivation. And similarly, the gauge transformations on states are not just a special case of those on solutions, but rather can be conceptually distinguished. So I'm just going to go through each of these in turn rather quickly because I don't have that much time left. So starting with why the extended Hamiltonian is naturally motivated in this framework without assuming anything about the gauge transformations, this falls out pretty naturally. If we just consider the vector field associated with the Hamiltonian and consider adding an arbitrary combination of the vector fields associated with the first class constraints, this is just the idea of just moving to this extended Hamiltonian, then we can use the fact that on the constraint surface, these vector fields associated with the first class constraints are the null vectors to see that the induced two-form acting on this transformed Hamiltonian is just equal to the induced two-form acting on the original one. But importantly, this induced two-form is precisely the structure that one uses to define the evolution of a system on the constraint surface. So what this means is that on the constraint surface, the evolution generated by the Hamiltonian vector field and this extended Hamiltonian vector field is not distinguished. Notice that we don't have to make any assumptions about whether the constraints are primary or secondary. The important thing is just that they're first class, since this is the property that determines the fact that they're these null directions. And this is what we're using to say what Hamiltonian vector fields are dynamically equivalent. And there's also no assumptions about the gauge transformations. It's just the structure of the constraint surface. Okay. So turning to the second thing, why the gauge transformations on states have this independent motivation. Well, we can use the fact that on the constraint surface, this induced two-form only acts on vector fields that are tangent to the constraint surface, which are precisely the vector fields that are constant along these gauge orbits. So what this means is that for functions that vary along the gauge orbit, the induced two-form effectively cannot see this change. So this means one cannot distinguish the value of a function at different points along a gauge orbit using the structure of a constraint surface. And this provides a sense in which these points are physically equivalent. So in this way, the structure of the constraint surface alone motivates the fact that each first class constraint generates a gauge transformation on states. And notice that this is in contrast to the way that Pons understood gauge transformations on states as being a particular case of those on solutions rather than being independently motivated. And now that we have these two things, it turns out that it just naturally falls out that the gauge transformations on solutions are given by arbitrary combinations of the first class constraints. Because we've seen that this equivalence class of Hamiltonians is given by the analog of the extended Hamiltonian, and the equivalence class of states is given by the gauge orbits. And so we have a natural reason to think that solutions related by transforming one, an arbitrary amount along the gauge orbit at each point in time, are physically equivalent. Namely, they are solutions generated by a Hamiltonian with a different combination of null vectors, and the states at each point are gauge equivalent. Okay, so what's the upshot of what I've just said? Well, it means that Dirac was right about the definition of a gauge transformation and the role of this extended Hamiltonian, but his reasoning was flawed. In particular, what I've argued is that restricting the equivalence class of Hamiltonians to those that only include an arbitrary combination of primary first class constraints, as Dirac did, and as this alternative view of gauge transformations assumes, is unnatural for two main reasons. Firstly, it distinguishes null vectors that are structurally equivalent. And second, it would be to say that the dynamics can distinguish states along a gauge orbit, even though the structure of the constraint surface is such that it cannot distinguish these states.
Another reason might be that just changing variables in the Lagrangian before you start seems like that would change which are the primary constraints.
Great. Yeah, I think that's right. So let me finish and say something about that. So what I think is the way that most people want to try and respond to what I've just said is to say that really it's only the total Hamiltonian that produces the correct Lagrangian equivalent gauge transformations. But what I've said is that doing so is to deny that the geometry of the constraint surface really captures the full picture. And just to give a couple options of how someone might go this way. First, one might try and say that there's really a different interpretation to be given to the primary and secondary constraints within the Hamiltonian formalism. Another option is to say that really it's the Lagrangian formalism that provides the basis for the distinction between primary and secondary constraints. So here's where I think your response might come about, which is to say, why can't we just change the way we write the Lagrangian in an equivalent way? And then what we get out is that the primary constraints when we move to the Hamiltonian formalism is different. Maybe it also includes what previously were the secondary ones. But some people want to push back on that and say that those changes to the Lagrangian are not equivalent to the one we had before. So while I think that there are issues with both of these options, I think that exploring these is the natural direction to go if one wants to maintain that this alternative view of gauge transformations is the right one. Okay, thank you, that's everything.
Okay, we have about 10 minutes for questions. Surely there must be something. Back here.
I was just going to ask if you could. So I heard Brian Pitts previously talk a little bit about his ideas, but I found it hard to absorb what his real point was. And I guess I want to ask you two things. Like, do you think he's right about whatever he was saying? And can you explain what he was saying?
Okay, yeah, so I take Brian Pitts to precisely be this alternative view that I'm trying to argue against. And actually, Brian Pitts's papers were part of the motivation for trying to give this kind of argument. So I think that at least the way he presents his view in the things that he writes is that he's saying precisely that we start with the total Hamiltonian, and when we do that, the gauge transformations on solutions are really this specific combination. So Dirac was wrong, his reasoning was wrong, and we should really do this other view. What I think is actually his view is precisely the thing I kind of ended with, that he thinks somehow that the Lagrangian view is the primary one, that we should privilege the Lagrangian one. The Hamiltonian one is really like derivative of the Lagrangian one, and that in the Lagrangian one, the correct gauge transformations are this specific combination. And so we should use that to motivate what our Hamiltonian picture should look like, and that in doing so, really, it's this alternative view that's the right one. And what I'm trying to say is that, firstly, for reasons just within the Hamiltonian framework, if we just take that at face value without considering the fact it comes from the Lagrangian ones, the natural gauge transformations are really the Dirac ones. And moreover, why should you be thinking, first, that you ought to privilege the Lagrangian formalism in this way, and second, that really what you've done is just translated them incorrectly, that really there's a different way to think about the relationship. It's not just there's an arbitrary combination in the Lagrangian, so it's an arbitrary combination in the Hamiltonian, but rather the way we're relating them is going wrong somewhere.
I guess the follow-up question is unanswerable psychological one, because I mean, I think Brian is a very clever guy, and so I don't think he would make any kind of technical error. So I just don't really understand why he takes the point of view he does, but I guess that's for another discussion.
Mm-hmm. My only thing to say there is what I've tried to capture in this talk is how you might be led to get to his conclusion. So I think he's perfectly right to say that if you start with thinking that the total Hamiltonian is the right one, you get this conclusion that first-class constraints on their own don't generate a map from a solution to another solution. They actually take you to what looks like not a solution at all. So if you're wedded to the idea that the total Hamiltonian is the right Hamiltonian, then you do get his conclusion. And what I'm trying to say is that that reasoning is not motivated to start with.
Rob and then Chris.
Okay. So this is all in the context of gauge theories, gauge fields, correct?
Yeah.
Do people think about carrying this over to gravity with diffeomorphism invariance and Hamiltonian? I mean, is this argument fully transferable to that context, or are there other subtleties and issues involved?
Yeah, so the subtlety, of course, is that when this formalism was, I think, I don't know the full history, but I think Dirac and people were motivated ultimately to think about quantizing gravity. And when you put general relativity through this formalism, which you can do pretty naturally, it doesn't change that much. The important thing that happens is, of course, you get that the Hamiltonian is a constraint, is a first class constraint. And now many people have thought about this case. I think that the thing I can say there is that what's interesting about the case of a Hamiltonian first class constraint is that my division between the gauge transformations on states and solutions becomes tied up in that case, because the gauge transformations on states just are the evolutions, just are the histories of your Hamiltonian. So just are these vector fields of the Hamiltonian. So this idea of these two kinds of different gauge transformations is tied up in that case. And I think that's where a lot of the conceptual issues people have seemed to think arise, is because these two notions have become tied up. But I don't see any reason to think that there's anything maybe wrong mathematically about what's going on there. So I think people have tried to say the thing that's wrong about the problem of time is that we've just wrong to start with, that the gauge transformations are not what we thought they were, even in the case, the normal classical non-gravitational case. And I've said that's not right, at least. you have to then argue that there's something special about that case to say that we've done something wrong there, maybe.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I just wanted to invite you to come back to the comparison between the Hamiltonian and Lagrangian approaches. So you mentioned that right at the end. And so it wasn't clear to me whether you think that somebody like Pitts, who starts from the Lagrangian formulation, is making a mistake of translation, and that a proper way of understanding them, you still get a sort of nice match between the different notions of gauge, or whether you think there's still an issue there.
How
do you address that? I didn't follow the last bit.
Firstly, I think it's something that I think I need to think more about, but I think probably my intuition is that really it's about this translation fact that's gone wrong, that there is another good way to write the Lagrangian formalism such that we get just this extended Hamiltonian formalism out and that we do have this natural translation. Now, I think there is something still conceptually interesting that some people have pointed out, which is that I've kind of taken for granted that we can just start with the Hamiltonian formalism where we just have a Hamiltonian and some constraints, and this defines this constraint surface. But some people will say something like, how do you get the constraints? They really are motivated from starting with the Lagrangian framework. So people do want to push back on, like, it seems like we need the Lagrangian formalism to even define to understand conceptually what the constraints are. So maybe there's something in that, but I think what I want to say is that that this idea that starting with the Lagrangian will somehow make the Hamiltonian framework look different, I don't think maybe is the right way to go.
Mm-hmm. Well, I want to just ask you a little bit more about the gravity case.
Mm-hmm.
Because where this runs into, I'm curious as to whether that's, I think that's part of Bryant's motivation, right? But I don't recall his reasoning, because what happens in gravity, trying to do canonical quantum gravity like this,
mm-hmm.
The way that Dirac was proposing was to take the constraints and then turn them into operators. And that's what gives you the new Dirac equation. And then the operators annihilate the states of the theory, the physical subspace have to be annihilated by the operators. That's the way of enforcing constraints. So is there any difference if you go down that road with your way of thinking versus Brian's way of thinking? What are the implications for Dirac constraint quantization, just to tie it into gravity?
Yeah, so I think, I don't know for sure, but I think Brian Pitts wants to say that if you understand that it's really the specific combination of first-class constraints that generates a gauge transformation, then the Hamiltonian on its own does not generate a gauge transformation. And the observables will be different in that case because they're only going to be the variables that are invariant under this specific combination of first-class constraints. And so I think what he wants to say is that in that way, I don't know if he wants to say you don't get the usual Wheeler-DeWitt equation out, but I think he does want to say that the observables change, and maybe in that way that the usual problems about only thinking about observables that don't change under time doesn't come about. So I think that's where he wants to kind of push towards, but I'm not completely sure.
Right, okay. Yeah, I mean, the question, I guess, is whether or not this, what looks like something that doesn't make a huge amount of difference in the theory on the classical level really becomes an important change.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, great. Yes, do you have another?
No,
we should move on. Okay, let's thank the speakers.